The following program is pre-recorded. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO show. We are starting a new series for 2011. Can you imagine it? 2011 already. And we welcome aboard, or I guess they welcome us aboard, whichever. We're glad to be part of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network now. And watching Joe and everybody down there over the years, lots of our friends on this network, and we're happy to be here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and we look forward to a long association with everyone there. In addition, they have an interesting little connection through most of southern Louisiana, from Baton Rouge all the way down to New Orleans, on an FM a group of small, low-powered stations that are linked together. And so we pick up a lot of listeners there as well. Good to be part of your operation, Joe. And here we are in 2011. Wow, can you believe that? I thought it would be pretty interesting to go ahead and do this this look back at 2010 on the first week of and the first month of 2011, look at some of the top stories for UFOs that we've done on the Jerry Pippin Show. Lots of important things happened in 2010 as far as UFOs are concerned. Stanley Fulham passed away after writing a book that caused a lot of commotion. And interestingly enough, some of his predictions appear to have come true. In addition to that, Rendlesham Forest had the 30th anniversary over in England. Some new information about that, maybe some hidden codes and other messages from ETs, a possibility. And down in South America, several countries still releasing lots of UFO material. Disclosure is still alive, at least in parts of the world. But let's concentrate on what we did. And we've done a lot of good shows over 2010, no doubt about it. But right toward the end of the year, Paula Harris came up with a very interesting story that actually is not new. It was published in a newspaper in New Mexico several years back. It concerns two little boys, 7 and 9 years old, who lived right outside of the White Sands missile base in 1945. And about a month after the nuclear test there, which the authorities said was an ammo dump that exploded, basically they had an encounter. It was during a thunderstorm, and they saw some ETs inside a crash craft. We'll play the entire show for you right now, and then we'll be back with some other top stories of 2010. I find this pretty earth-shaking news. Listen to it and let me know what you think. You can always contact me here at jerry@jerrypippin.com. Love to hear from you.
75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they?
Jim Sullivan was an entertainer. He was married, and he had a young son. He left California for Nashville. Jim had $120 in his pocket, and he drove straight from California to Santa Rosa, New Mexico. On a March day in 1975, Sullivan took his VW and drove away from Santa Rosa after spending the night out into the desert, and he disappeared forever. Days later, after he was reported missing, police found his car. It was abandoned in the middle of nowhere. Inside his car was his guitar, wallet, luggage, and date books. Also, there were a few copies of his latest release. UFO.
Shaking like a leaf on the desert heat. His daddy's got a bang that's so hard to beat. I bought me a ticket, got a front row seat. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye. Looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO? Did he come by UFO?
Jim Sullivan. A lot of people think perhaps he was abducted. Did he have a meeting with the ETs? Strange things happen in New Mexico. New Mexico has probably more stories about UFOs and high strangeness than any state in the Union. As you know, we do a lot of shows from New Mexico. We're going to do a show tonight on this program that is really, truly groundbreaking. The old term breaking news is for sure on this story that Paula Harris has come forward with. We'll be talking to two witnesses who were young boys in New Mexico when they witnessed a UFO crash, even saw the ETs inside the craft. It happened in 1945, that's right, almost 2 years before Roswell. We'll get into all of that, but first of all, let's welcome Paula Harris to the show. And Paula, you've been hanging around Boulder. You've not been moving around
much.
Yes,
I just finished my fourth book, and I had to stay put.
Paula, I don't think we can overstate the story. You've really come up with what I would consider the story of the century. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit of how this came about, how you got into this.
Pretty impressed, too, Jerry. This is probably the second biggest story I've covered. The first one was Colonel Philip Corso. And, you know, that was the Roswell anniversary of 1997. And he, for me, changed the whole, you know, sense of ufology because he talked about the back engineering of alien technology. Well, you know, this is the second one, and it's another New Mexico-type situation. It's a crash that happened in 1945, 2 months after the atomic bomb testing on the Trinity site. And, of course, you know, people look at San Antonio, and it's not San Antonio, Texas. It's San Antonio, New Mexico. Realize that it's very close to the Trinity site, to Ground Zero. Something or somebody was watching all of that, and because of the intervention of two little Hispanic boys that lived in that area, we have another eyewitness account of a UFO crash. And the amazing part about this, Jerry, is they not only saw the craft crash, they walked up to it. They were about 200 yards away from it, and they saw the beings inside. And to add to this, one of the little boys, the older one, Jose Padilla, 9 years old, when he sees that the craft is unattended on a flatbed truck, runs up to the flatbed, opens up the tarp and goes inside the craft and pulls off.
I talked to both of them, Jose and Remy. And we recorded the conversations, and let's play right here, right now, them talking about how they got this piece of the UFO.
At one time, we sneaked out, Remy and I sneaked out there on the horses again to go and wash, and they had five men imposed there, five soldiers imposed there. One of them was imposed, and the four were working on that craft. Trying to fix up, they built an L-frame to set up on a lowboy trailer to hold it away. And they worked on that for almost a week. But we used to go there a little late in the evening and watch from top of the hill. And I noticed that four of them used to get on their jeep and go and take off to a bar that used to be called still the Owl Bar and Cafe to have fun out there. And one of them used to stand poster. And it happened that they had loaded this piece of crap, you know, on a lowboy trailer. That last day that they were there, I remember, it was a Saturday. And we stayed there a little later than usual. And I noticed that there, all five soldiers jumped in the Jeep and took off to the bar. At that time, we waited about 30 minutes. We hopped on our horses and ran out down to the where the trailer was. And they had a tarp over it tied down. Remy went and ahead and untied the rope from the tarp. And I hopped in that trailer and went in through that hole.
What did you see in there?
Nothing. It was clear except for one thing that was in there. There was a panel. There was this piece of material that like a handle that I tried to yank it out, and I couldn't. So I jumped off the trailer and went over and got a bar, they call a cheater bar that they tied the chains on a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
I went over and stuck that bar underneath there and ripped that thing right off.
How big of a piece was it?
Oh, but 14 inches long.
What do you think it was used for?
At that time and at times and now, I think how it was mounted on that panel, it was like a radar mechanism that they would operate with to handle that sheep.
Jose Padillo in California and Remy Baca up in Washington State at Gig Harbor. Paula, you actually spent some time at Remy's. That's a strange name.
Remy. Remigo. And it's short is Remy. He moved away later on in life, went up to Washington State, and he probably will tell you he spent a lot of time in Washington State politics, and he couldn't talk about this story for many years. His wife is Roman Catholic and did not believe in UFOs and thought they shouldn't touch it until they had a sighting in 1994, and then his wife became a believer. She saw the UFO over their house. In my interview with her, she talks about being emotionally connected and that she started to cry because it was such a shocker. The craft was right over their house at a very low altitude. And that helped, her with digest this whole phenomenon. And it was then that Remy could talk about it, in a public format. And of course he had already talked to Jose Padilla. They had found each other after many years, and they both had made a decision to come public.
Yeah, Paula, we mentioned you went up to Gig Harbor. Actually, that was this year in July.
Yeah, July 4th, 4th of July, yeah. I happened to be in Washington State for the East SETI Conference, the James Gilliland situation, and I just went up to Gig Harbor from there. But I wanted to tell you that, the way I got the story was another man had contacted me because he had written to me on internet and told me that his father was the pilot that flew the bodies out of the 1945 crash. And then I began to ask, well, what crash in 1945? And this person sent me his father's documents, his father's picture, and then gave me the telephone number of Remy Baca. And that's how I got in touch with him. You know, I said, is this true? Was there something in 1945? And then he talked to me for a long period of time. He began to trust me, and we made a decision that we would work together to release the story.
Paula, do you mind if we get back to the core story and pick it up where Jose and Remy saw the ETs and the crash?
No. What Remy and Jose saw after the dust cleared, because they saw there was a big storm in New Mexico. I hope they talk about this because we have the lightning storm. It also happened during the Roswell crash.
That's one of the first things I noticed about this story that really got my attention. It caught my attention.
Yeah, it caught mine too because I know that's a problem. It interferes with the navigation system of these craft. And there was also a radar tower there, really close. So whatever happened that caused this avocado-shaped round craft the crash is very, very important. And then the two little boys slowly walked up to it, you know, and with binoculars looked inside and saw three creatures that Remy describes as floating instead of walking, back and forth. They looked like they were floating.
August 16th, 1945, when Remy and I mounted two horses, and we ran into a heavy thunderstorm. So we dodged down underneath some rocks, and we heard a sonic boom. And I looked back at him and I said, "There must be another bomb test, you know, just because before that, a month before that, they had just tested that first atomic bomb." July 16th.
I asked them if they heard an engine noise or anything, and Remy and actually Jose replied that, well, listen.
No, it's just like a sonic boom and like a lot of metal scraping the ground. We mounted the horses again, and we seen some smoke coming out of the other reach, and so we mounted the horses. We went over the hill and came out on the other side, and we seen this big object. The ground was smoking, which was burning. We stopped there. A wedge on the ground cut a sideways. I have a feeling that there used to be a tower, some kind of a radio tower at Italian Peak, which is about 3 miles north from there. I believe that lightning was the one who contacted that, and they hit the tower, you know, and that's what made the big hole in the side. We got down to about almost, probably about a football field long, 210 yards probably, except that it was so hot there, you know, and smoky that we could hardly see much. We've seen, with the binoculars, I seen inside there, three young men, you know, creatures, just walking back and forth real fast, squeaking, sashaying from one end to the other. What we could see through that hole, you know. They looked like a, because we were young kids then, they looked like a red ant standing up. With Kampamocha. I don't know if you ever heard that word.
Kampamocha is a like a praying mantis, big eyes, you know. Yeah.
So they were insect-like.
Well, the head was.
The head looked like that.
So as you heard there, Paula, they seem to think that the UFO hit the tower rather than the lightning bringing it down. However, I've heard that the radar itself was used as a weapon, you know, affecting the avionics and knocking these UFOs out of the sky. Have you ever heard that story?
Well, I haven't heard that, but I did hear that it was very dangerous for these craft, and that Colonel Corso, when he was head of the missile battalion in Red Canyon, was asked to shut his radars down during certain times of the day. And to shut them down meant because they were having problems. That's when he had his sighting, when he didn't shut it down one time, and then he had that contact experience.
Paula, let's mention again the location. This Padilla Ranch was close to White Sands Missile Base, and actually very close to where they tested the atomic bomb.
Because if you ask them, they'll tell you how they lived through the bomb blast. I mean, I think it was Remy whose bed went from one side of the room to the other. And I think it was Jose, whose mother was half blinded by the...
Yeah, she was looking out the door, and the flash came off and injured her eye, actually blinded her.
And they didn't tell him that's what was happening. They made up another story about the proof.
I mean, years later, they still weren't admitting it was an atomic blast. They were saying it was an ammo dump.
So they never told the inhabitants how dangerous
it was. I'm truly surprised these two guys are still here. I mean, that place had to be covered with radiation.
And they said at that time that San Antonio, the city, had a very small population. I don't know, you know, exactly 300 or something. So it's a very small town.
Paula Harris is our guest. And Paula, we've had the prelude kind of set up the show. Next, we're going to get into the body of the program and really cover some of the details. That's coming up next on the Jerry Pippin Show. Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of jerrypippin.com. It happened in the late afternoon. A very heavy thunderstorm pounded the mesquite and greasewood covered desert west of old US 85. This is where now Milepost 130 is located, the San Antonio exit on Interstate 25. It was a far different time in that part of New Mexico from what it is now. The Patello Ranch, isolated and close to the White Sands testing ground, which sprawled out like a giant tarantula in the desert, holding secrets that still exist today, somewhere deep in the archives of the Pentagon. No one knew, except for the Army, which launched a recovery operation looking for the crashed UFO. At least that's what the officials thought at the time, but no one knew but them. But there were two small boys, 1-7 and 1-9, Remy Baca and Jose Padello. They watched from a nearby hill. They had seen the crash of the craft up close and personal. They even saw what was inside, something these boys kept to themselves for decades. Extraterrestrial creatures with big eyes, and they were squealing in pain like injured jackrabbits in the desert. However, there's more to the story, and we have investigative reporter Paula Harris with us. She's on the line from Boulder, Colorado. Paula, this story with these two men now in their 70s certainly backs up the idea that UFOs have been investigating nuclear activities by the United States and other countries for some time, all the way back to World War II. You know quite a lot about this story. You even spent some time up in Gig Harbor, Washington, with one of the men, Remy. I mean, you even had that mile marker location down pat. It'll be in your book, which is coming out in February. I'm very impressed, as always, with your work.
Yeah. near there. But the I think they have 180,000 acres on that ranch. So it isn't, like, easy to find. The thing is, too, that they were thinking, you know, even in the future, to get involved with the city of Socorro, New Mexico, and have, you know, maybe the piece that they took in a museum there, or have this story planted there in Socorro, so that people all over the world, and kids, and you know, people that are interested could have a place to go to look at that.
You know, Paula, this entire area of New Mexico is full of UFO stories. I mean, have you heard about Lonnie Zamora, the police officer who saw the Socorro UFO? I'm sure you have. And that's not very far
from
there.
That's right. You need to ask Remy about that, because they knew who Zamora was. And I think that you had even talked to him, because this is all connected to that. So if people were doing their homework, they would connect the dots down there about what it was. The sheriff's name was Eddie Apodaca, and he, I think, was also connected with that case. So, you know, we need to know who knew whom, and the dates of when all of this happened, and so forth.
Well, one of the things about this story is the fact that all the way back to 1945, there's evidence of UFOs prying around the area where we were developing nuclear weapons. Later on, this was carried out in nuclear silos, missile bases, all kinds of stories about that. Seems to be an ET UFO nuclear connection, don't you think?
Yeah, and it, mainly from a letter that Einstein and Oppenheimer wrote to President Truman. It's one of the Majestic 12 documents. I can send it to you if you want to. Where in June of 1947, Einstein and Oppenheimer said there was too much activity in that site, to Trinity site, and that they had had so many sightings that they had come to the conclusion that we were being visited by extraterrestrial cultures, and what were we going to do about it? That they had opened Pandora's box, and that they wanted a structure, a super United Nations, to deal with this. And this letter was sent to it was drafted, and Vannevar Bush canceled it out, said it would never go to Truman. And, of course, you know he was one of the Majestic 12 people. But why would Oppenheimer and Einstein try to address all of these sightings? Plus, they use the word extraterrestrial biological entity in the letters, in these documents. Why did they use that when Roswell had not happened yet? This document is dated in June of 1947.
Now, this particular sighting happened in August of 1945. Roswell happened in 1947 in July, 1 year, 11 months later. Seems to be a connection.
That's right. But I'm beginning to wonder how many other crashes happened before Roswell. Remy is very clear when he says the crew that cleaned up this particular crash was inexperienced, because they were throwing pieces in a trench, and they were not wearing hazmat suits. They were not worried about radiation. Why would they go to the Owl Cafe and leave unattended this craft? I mean, there was not the meticulous cleaning up that was done for Roswell. So I think this is one of the first crashes ever in that area.
I assume this crash was under the control of the White Sands missile people. And that's interesting, Paula, how they handled it is different from Roswell. Roswell released a press release right away bragging about it. White Sands used to secrecy, of course, didn't mention it.
White Sands, right. It was the same guys that were there.
I wonder if those soldiers told anybody at that cafe, that bar, about what they were doing. Small town, you know, people were curious.
Oh, I don't know, but that same cafe is where Oppenheimer used to. See, this is why I believe the Oppenheimer-Einstein letter, because that's the same cafe that he used to go to when he was, you know, there were very few watering holes there in that area. There's nothing there. And so that was the only place people met. And apart from being a bar, it was a cafe and a food place. So, you know, this is 1945. They just... Nobody went by there, and if it wasn't for these two little boys, who told their father, the Padilla father, that about what happened, then we wouldn't have even had this story.
Interestingly enough, this was actually a story that was printed in the Socorro, New Mexico newspaper several years ago by Ben Moffat, I think, was the reporter.
Yeah, Mountain Mail paper, but then in addition, he was also a classmate of Remy's. So, you mean, they went to school together.
Yeah, is Ben Moffat still alive?
Yeah, he is. And I gave him credit when I did the interview for Coast, because he's the one that wrote the first story on it. And it was an amazingly good story that he wrote. It was in 2003, and that's what brought the story out. Now, because I'm not the first one to hear about this story. Other researchers that heard about it, Ryan Wood, has talked to them. It came out because it was written by Ben Moffat. So we have a lot of real responsible journalists.
You would have thought that once that story was published, it would have skyrocketed around the world. But I hadn't heard about it until you brought it to my attention.
Gary, you know, I don't know how to say this, but it has to be one of us that takes this on. And because of my position internationally, I'm a very well-known international investigative journalist. I released it first in Italy. I mean, it's been written about on two issues of X Times magazine in Italy. And then... I released it secondly in the UK with UFO Matrix with Philip Mantle and that group. And lastly, I released it in the United States on a big level, because somehow when things get out here, nobody covers them and nobody takes it seriously. And so if I can do anything at all, and like you're doing right now, to tell people this is a historical event, and it's real, and it happened, and we need to look at it, then you and I are doing the best we can to work in the United States on this.
Paula, when these two boys saw the ETs inside the craft, they were alive. Have you ever followed up or tried to follow up about what happened to the ETs? I mean, no, that's not an easy job. I mean,
it isn't. Either they have a recovery team of their own, the aliens, where they come and get their own people, or they were, you know, taken by the military, which I don't think happened, or they were loose in the desert, which I've heard of too, because in those days the ET, some of them alive, were found wandering around the desert. So, you know, all of, especially if they're connected with a ship, which Colonel Corso said they were. They were used to fly ship. They're extraterrestrial biological entities. So, I don't know. Nobody knows. And all that Remy and Jose can tell you is what they saw. They saw the beings, and they'll describe them for you.
Interesting. When I talked to Jose and Remy, they brought up the chance or the idea that the beings may have just left the craft and were wandering around in the desert.
Possibility. I've heard of that, too. I mean, that the beings are, you know, kind of, they probably could wander around the desert, or maybe they were recovered by their own.
Well, we make every effort to pick up our pilots and other people down in action. Why wouldn't the ETs?
That's true. That's absolutely true. All that Remy and Jose will tell you is the following recovery, period, that they didn't see them anymore. They weren't there.
Both Jose and Remy, I talked to them both, and they seem to have some strange reactions. Once they got close to the craft, after it crashed, and they saw the creatures inside, they described it as almost sadness, like at a funeral. And they both sensed that these creatures were hurting physically. And they had other things happening to them, at least mentally. Paula, I know you pretty well. I know you talked to both of them about this and how they felt about it and the emotions and everything involved.
How did you feel when he said, I felt panicking like they had been hurt or something? And he also got pictures in his mind. He had some kind of contact with these beings, because in his later life he explains, he's writing a book, I think it's called Born in Ground Zero, Living in the Shadow of Area 51. That's his book that he spent a lot of time writing. He talks about his ability to his ESP ability later on in his life, and his ability to predict lottery numbers right up to the end, and his ability to sense things. And this could have come from contact with these beings. We have to look at this. Anybody that is in contact with ET beings has an enhanced ESP ability. And I had asked Remy in detail about that, and he had told me these incidences where this happened. Now, also, he and Ginny, Virginia, had that sighting in 1994, too, so maybe there was something from that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if that was connected.
Well, it wasn't the same kind of ship. What they saw in Washington State was a regular saucer-shaped craft, kind of round on the bottom, something like he said what was in Close Encounters. And what fell in San Antonio was an avocado-shaped craft. And you can ask Jose, who lives in California, about the top part of that. It had a little, he said, almost like a little a window part, or a little observatory part on the top part of that avocado shape.
Paula, it's interesting. The Sikora craft, I think in 67, was described as egg-shaped. And that's not much different than an avocado. So maybe they're related. Maybe the same thing, same people, same ETs, same craft. You know what I mean?
Well, that's an important setting. Is there anybody left from that particular case? Is there any? Are there any witnesses that are still alive from, Lonnie's Laura had talked to?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. Ray Stanford's still around, and we have another show to do with him. And he was the premier investigator on that, the Socorro incident.
What if they're the same kind of group? They have the same kind of avocado-shaped craft, which is round.
I think Colonel Corso told you something interesting about who he thought were flying these things.
There was something going on that very interested an extraterrestrial race. And it didn't necessarily mean that who's inside the craft is who was interested, because Colonel Corso told me that what he believed was inside the craft were the navigators for the creators of those. In other words, they were supposed to report back that the creators of these beings were probably look like us.
Very, very interesting, Paula. You know, it suddenly occurred to me we really haven't plugged the books properly. So, Paula, it's your turn. Plug away, baby.
My book is called Exopolitics, Gateway to a New Reality, Stargate to a New Reality. And it's going to come out in February at the International UFO Congress in Phoenix. And it has the 53-page interview with the witnesses of the 1945 crash, but it also has interviews with pilots, with Guy Kirkwood, with Milton Torres, with Jean-Jacques Dubac, the Cometa pilot, with pilots and military men who've given me other interviews. So the book is, like all my other books, filled with interviews.
Paula, you've known me, and I've known you for a long time. We've worked together on several projects. You're like me. You seem to be speeding up, doing more and more.
Well, they're coming to me. There's more and more stories. And you know why? I mean, I just talked to Don Schmidt about this. It's almost like a race with the Undertaker. People get to be a certain age. They get to be 70, 80 years old, and they decide they're going to talk. They decide before they pass on, they want to leave this for the history of humanity, what they lived through, and they are firsthand witnesses. And they're more important than me. I'm just a reporter. They're very important, and we must record this. So I have a real passion for recording this firsthand testimony, and like Schmidt and Carey do too, for a historical event, and that's what I believe.
You mentioned the UFO Congress and it moving to Phoenix, no longer in Laughlin.
Yeah, it's in Phoenix this year. I'm so used to calling it Laughlin. I got to stop. But I'm on the board of directors.
You're very active with the UFO Congress, Paula. You going to stay on the board, or do they even have a board anymore, or what's happening?
Well, I don't know if they're still going to keep them, but they've offered us to come down and meet at least once. And, of course, we're going to miss Wendell. He was, you know, on our board, and our, you know, he was our godfather.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I've got to be honest, I'm going to miss the Browns. I mean, it was a family operation. I love Bob Brown and Terry Brown.
Yeah, Wendell Stevens, you mentioned, and Terry Brown, both are now deceased. But Bob and his daughter are still around and alive and well. Let's get back to this 1945 UFO crash for a moment. I know you're going to make a presentation there in Phoenix about it, and the book will be available. This is just a shocking story. I don't know any other word to use.
Yeah, I was in shock, Jerry, because they're telling the truth, and I'm thinking, what's going on here? Like, what's happening? We have a crash that we have, not only the witnesses to the crash, but one of the little boys goes aboard the craft, and you know, why there? Why, you know, how come this hasn't been talked about before? Certainly there must have been some military people. And you know, I'm hoping they're going to come out of the woodwork, and the people that were involved with this, we all have more witnesses. Because when we cover a story like this, what happens is people finally decide to talk. But as Remy said, they're going to be in their 90s or 80s, because these guys are 74 years old. And if you were in the military, you had to be at least 20 years older. So that puts you almost 90.
As we've noted on the air many times about these New Mexico UFO crashes, unfortunately, the Undertaker is winning. Many of the witnesses are now gone.
It's a race. Yeah, it's a race to get the real people. And, you know, they all take an oath. I mean, even the boys, you know, were told by the military, don't talk about this. And we're not discussing. But they told Jose's father that it was a weather balloon, because, and I hope Jose talks about this, they asked permission to cut the gate because they couldn't get the flatbed out to carry the weather balloon out. So, you know, that's a
pretty... Well, the old weather balloon story raises its head again. It was before Roswell, and the story is still going on.
They were going to cut this guy's gate. He has a farm, you know.
Uh-huh.
They asked permission to put a new gate on there to do all this altering. It's not their property where this thing fell. And, you know, so they had to do... The cover-up started then, but I'm not sure who was in charge in 1945.
Well, I understand.
And, but I do think, and if somebody asked me about this, because of Einstein, Oppenheimer, even Wernher von Braun, you know, I've been talking to Carol Rosen about this. You know, he knew. They knew about this kind of stuff. Wernher von Braun told Clark McClellan that he had been to Roswell and had seen the bodies. Yeah, here's a paperclip scientist who, I mean, God knows what all happened in Germany, whether there were crashes there.
I guess there's lots of reasons why we're not going to get disclosure, or it doesn't appear that we will. Paula, patents, for one thing, back engineering, everything given to private enterprise. That could be challenged.
Well, that's part of it. But you know that these craft do not use gas and oil. They do not. It's a free energy discussion, and I don't think maybe the world is ready to embrace a new kind of paradigm right now. And if these things have been back engineered, they have been back engineered without the use of fossil fuels, and we've got an economy that's based on a lot of things that could possibly, you know, just fall and crash if the truth were to come out. The other reason, they started lying a long time ago. They're going to have to admit they lied. Can you see the Air Force saying, Roswell really did happen, we lied five times with five different excuses? No, they can't do that. I don't think that's something they're going to do. I don't know how this would ever come out. I certainly don't think any president's going to announce it.
Paula, I think that's a good way to leave it. Food for thought. Thanks for being on and telling us about the 1945 UFO crash in New Mexico.
Thank you, Jerry.
Talk to you again soon. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found it. Although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking. So well researched, Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO show.
Better be something intelligent, then don't buy the Inquirer. We don't need you. Then you buy the New York Review of Literature, you buy the Partisan Review, you buy the Harper's, you buy Atlantic, the National Enquirer, UFO sightings. That's the caliber, right? UFO sightings, and never by anybody intelligent. Have you noticed that? A UFO has never landed at Harvard or Yale or Princeton. And a saucer has never landed on a Jewish lawn because we would turn it over to see who made it.
It's Joan Rivers, and now we do know, actually, why the UFOs never land anywhere but out in the deserts of New Mexico and Nevada. It's because, evidently, UFOs are monitoring what we've been doing with nuclear power since 1945. Maybe a little earlier, even. For instance, the story we have been doing on the UFO crash of 1945 and what happened within a month of the atomic bomb test there at the White Sands Proving Grounds, shortly before we dropped the bomb on Japan. We have two witnesses who are still alive, and they were there for the incident, Jose Padilla and Remy Baca. They were childhood friends. They witnessed the UFO crash together, and they even were able to hide a piece of the UFO from everyone. Both of them left their home in San Antonio, New Mexico, and moved out to the West Coast in the mid-50s. In other words, they didn't see each other for several decades, but suddenly, by a quirk of fate and the Internet, they were able to find each other again because Remy Baca was doing some genealogy research and ran across Jose. When they witnessed the UFO accident, Remy was only 7 and Jose was 9. San Antonio only had about 60 people as a population. So in those days, everybody knew everybody. The incident that we've done on our show with Paula Harris actually happened on August 16, 1945. The two young boys were on horseback looking for a very special cow with calves. And they were supposed to check it out and then go home and tell Jose's father whether the cow was okay or not. But they were out there, and a very heavy thunderstorm came up. And while they were underneath a ledge, they heard a tremendous roar and a crash. It happened over the next hill from them. When they got over there, they saw a big hole in a craft and three creatures. They looked like they were ants, but they were standing straight up, according to the two boys. They were moving around in the craft, and they were squealing with pain. Listen to how both Remy and Jose describe it.
The noise that they were making, like I told Remy, you know, they're injured. They were making a noise like a jackrabbit when he's injured. Yeah.
Yeah, a real high squeaky sound.
They were afraid to get too close to the object, and when it started getting dark, they decided to get back on their horses and go home. They told Jose's father about it, and he said they would go back out there and check out the situation in a day or two. But back to the creatures and whether or not they were injured, listen to Jose and Remy kind of flush this out.
Well, you can tell because it was really weird. I had never been to a movie, or of course TV wasn't around, and neither had Jose, I think, or maybe he had. But in any event, we heard these sounds that would come into your head, real high pitched, you know, almost hurt your ears, you know. And then there was these images that were coming, you know, through our minds. As such, and you got you kind of like when you're in a funeral, you know, little kid at the funeral, you really feel sad for the person that passed. Well, that's the kind of feelings that we were getting from them, and you were getting the feeling that they were hurt, as such, and so that was why the concern of trying to going in there. Jose wanted to go in there and see what was going on. As such. Am I right, Jose?
That's right.
Okay.
You stop me from it.
Both Jose and Remy insist that the creatures never tried to get off the ship. They were just moving around inside. In fact, lots of things were happening. Astounding to anyone, but especially to two young boys, 7 and 9. Listen to what Remy has to say about what was happening in his mind.
In between looking at them, hearing the squeaks, and seeing these images. I mean, not only are we, you know, we're seeing these images of big buildings just crumbling, you know, and just utter destruction, you know, fire, you know, and
now, this was in your mind's eye?
Yeah, that was in our minds. And and you're, I mean, you're just utterly confused, and you're, I mean, you're really feeling bad for them, as such. And yet, you know, I mean, we're from a small town. The biggest building we had was a one-story adobe house, you know. And these are huge buildings. I had never seen anything like that at that age, anyway. And there were none around there. And then we saw, like, you know, we didn't have any TV then, so, you know, couldn't compare it to anything. But in the old TVs that we had, right, when the TVs first came up, and remember that picture going down all the time, you know, the tube type, and it started fluttering, the picture started.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what we, you know, that's what we saw. And through that rolling, you'd see things like numbers just go on really fast. You know, too fast for us to even comprehend, you know. The only thing we figured out is maybe it was a calendar or something, you know, but just numbers going by, you know, and these buildings, and, oh, man, it was a terrible experience.
I asked Jose about the ship, what it looked like. What shape was it?
Oval. It was kind of a round oval, let's say about 30 feet in diameter and about 15 feet high.
And what was the color of the ship?
It was like a real dirty aluminum. We would just stay there, you know, watching them see what they would do. And it started, at that time, you know, it started to get dark late in the evening. So I wanted to go in there, but Remy wouldn't let me in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we finally, you know, got back on the horses, you know, and took off and went back to the ranch. Yeah, by the time we got back to the ranch, it was pitch dark. My father was waiting for us, and I told him, you know, Dad, you know, we found that cow and the calf, and they're doing okay. And I turned around and I said, we found something else. And he asked us, what, you know? Well, I started to explain, you know, that this big object, you know, fell from the sky. And I told him about those little creatures that were running around in the inside. And for a while there, he wouldn't believe me. And by that time, you know, he says, wait a couple of days and we'll go check it out the following, you know, couple of days. And by that time, we went over and got in the pickup truck and went over and took Remy home.
It was almost 2 days before they came back to the wreck of the UFO. They had a friend of Jose's dad, who happened to be a state trooper, who came out with them to see the wreckage. And Jose goes on with the story.
And that's when we seen that object that was all covered up with, like, with dust. And it seems like someone had cleaned up around the debris. And that the highway patrolman got off, and my dad, they said, you guys stay over here. They went ahead and went inside that the craft. They look around. They came out, you know, and it says, you guys, it said, don't say anything to no one.
Interestingly enough, the only thing left was the shell of the craft. Everything inside was empty, gone, taken.
No, everything was gone.
Even the creatures were missing.
Yeah, the creatures, we kept pressing them to see if they see them or if they knew where they had gone, because we were concerned. We called them, you know, hombrecitos, little guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of pressed them, and they said, no, we see there's no hombrecitos around here. And it says, but they proceeded to tell us, you know, how this was going to be handled. Eddie basically said, you know, this belongs to the military, more than likely, and they'll probably want it back. They call them air balloons. You know, one of the things that we want to do is that you're going to have to keep your mouth shut, otherwise you can get in a lot of trouble. And so if anybody wants to know anything about this, you send them to me. I'll talk to them.
Well, afterwards, It's been a couple of days after we returned back to the house. There was a soldier from the military there came over and talked to my dad. And Rami and I had just got some groceries from the store, and we had just got home to our ranch, my ranch, and went out through the back door when that gentleman was talking to my dad. We went in there as little nosy kids, started listening to it, and we heard, you know, that that officer told my dad, you know, that he was going to ask permission to cut the fence so that they could be able to get a weather balloon that belonged to them.
The old weather balloon story came up, even in 1945, before Roswell. I asked Jose if he believed the weather balloon story, and here's his answer.
No. My dad and I used to pick up weather balloons and turn them into that military before that, when I was younger than that. But they used to fall there on our ranch. That wasn't no weather balloon. The balloon, a weather balloon is made out of materials like canvas, nylon, and there was no canvas or nylon on that.
A big part of the story is the fact that Remy and Jose came up with a piece of the UFO. I asked him about that, how that happened.
At one time, we sneaked out, Remy and I sneaked out there on the horses again to go and wash. And they had five men in poster, five soldiers in poster. One of them was in post, and the four were working on that craft, trying to fix up. They built an L-frame to set up on a lowboy trailer to hold it away. And they worked on that for almost a week. But we used to go there a little late in the evening and watch from top of the hill. And I noticed that four of them used to get on their jeep and go and take off to a bar that used to be called, still the Oval Bar and Cafe, to have fun out there. And one of them used to stay in poster. And it happened that they had loaded this piece of crap, you know, on a lowboy trailer. That last day that they were there, I remember, it was a Saturday. And we stayed there a little later than usual. And I noticed that all five soldiers jumped in the jeep and took off to the bar. At that time, we waited about 30 minutes. We hopped on our horses and ran out down to where the trailer was. And they had a tarp over it tied down. Remy went on ahead and untied the rope from the tarp. And I hopped in that trailer and went in through that hole.
What did you see in there?
Nothing. It was clear, except for one thing that was in there. There was a panel. There was this piece of material that like a handle that I tried to yank it out, and I couldn't. So I jumped off the trailer and went over and got a bar, they call a shooter bar that they tied the chains on a trailer. I went over and stuck that bar underneath there and ripped that thing right off.
How big of a piece was it?
Oh, about 14 inches long.
What do you think it was used for?
At that time and at times and now, I think how it was mounted on that panel, it was like a radar mechanism that they would operate with to handle that sheep.
The two boys said they saw nothing inside the craft except a straight floor. Everything had been taken. I asked Jose about windows. Were there windows in the craft?
Except on the top. On the top rear, there was a little dome.
Well, one of the things that was significant was that there was the stuff that, similar to angel hair, you know, we used it for Christmas to decorate our trees because we didn't have any electricity. But this, the angel hair there was a lot of it, you know, on the inside of the of that craft. And so that was one of the things that was, you know, significant about it. In fact, that's one year I took some of that angel hair with me, and we used it on our Christmas tree. Really glittered. I mean, it just picks up the lights really well, you know. Really neat.
Of course, the big mystery was what happened to the creatures. They were gone.
Right now, you know, I think that they might have had some scouts or something, you know, that they came over and got them.
You mean their own?
Because the materials that were there in the craft, they were gone. If there was any materials or anything, except for that piece that I we took.
One of the surprising elements about the story is how long, how slow the Army took in recovering the craft itself and hauling it away.
It was the 18th until the 25th. The 25th was the last day when they covered it up. That's when we went in. That night, they took it. I would say they might have taken it out at midnight.
And Jose started school at the age of 4, you know. He had like a photographic mind, so he remembered dates, places, times, and so forth.
What the two boys did with the piece of the UFO is an interesting story in itself.
Remy put it on inside the saddlebag, one of the saddles, you know, on the horses. We took it back to a ranch. We left it there at night, and about 3 days later, I grabbed that piece and I went over and took it over to his house. Because soldiers were coming over searching that ranch. They were looking for something.
So they knew that piece was missing, you figure?
Well, I guess they must have taken inventory, you know, when they loaded that up. Then when they got over there to the yard, you know, I guess something was missing there. When I came to California, I picked it up and brought it over here.
Okay.
Okay, when we discovered each other in 2003, I believe, Remy?
Right.
Yeah. I sent it over to him. I tried, you know, melting a piece of it.
It wouldn't melt?
No, it take pretty hot degrees to melt it. But it wouldn't melt from the outside, though. It would just bubble up from the inside. Seemed like it was a hard crust on the outside of the metal.
Well, initially, there in San Antonio, while the soldiers were looking for it, and he brought it over to my house for me to hide, and I put it under the floorboards of what we used to call a grain room, where we put all the corn and so forth, and that grain room was. There was a sheep herder that came in every year and stayed there for about half a month or so, and he gave my dad a lamb, you know, for the rent, and so this guy stayed there, and so I had buried it on the northeast corner under the floorboards, dirt, you know, in the house, in that room, and so. That sheep herder came in and was staying there, and he had been there, but you know, a day or so, not very long. And my dad had come. My dad, see, one of the reasons that we had to really be careful is because my dad worked for the government, and Jose's dad worked for the government. So you know, you got to be careful. You know, that's what Eddie, the state patrolman, told us. So anyway, so you have to be careful. And so you know, so that's where we put it. About in the morning, one morning, the sheep herder. My dad was home on for the weekend, and that sheep herder came in. He came over to the house. We were having breakfast. You know, I didn't see my dad like only maybe once. Once every 30 days, you know, and sometimes not even that, you know, that much. But anyway, we were having breakfast, and he knocked on the door, and I opened the door, answered it, and he wanted to talk to my dad, so I invited him in, and my dad, you know, said, okay, have a cup of coffee while I finish breakfast here, you know. And so he says, okay, so then he told him, he says, you know, last night, you know, I was sleeping. You know, I was asleep, and, you know, and I heard some noise, you know, and so I woke up, and there was a big bright light over by the well, where right close to the wood pile. It says, and so I looked out there, but there was nobody there. And then all of a sudden, there's these creatures standing right in front of me, and they're pointing under that down there under the floorboards, and they're saying tesoro, tesoro. You know? And so the only people that knew what tesoro was Jose and I, because that's the name of the piece. Yeah, that's what we called it. Yeah. And so, and do you know, I thought my soul was going to leave my body, you know, because my dad doesn't know about what happened. He couldn't know. And now this guy, the sheep herder, is, you know, so my dad says, okay, let's go down there and see what's going on, you know. So they grabbed a shovel, and we went over to the house, pulled up a couple of floorboards, got in there, dug a hole right where he had pointed, but there was nothing there. And while they're digging that hole, I mean, you know, I'm praying.
Yeah.
I am praying, you know.
Yeah.
And, but they didn't find anything there. As such. And so then my dad says, well, he says, well, you know, he says, maybe it's, you know, everything's okay now, so everything should be all right, you know. If it happens again, let me know, you know. And so, you know, we left, and the sheeper stayed there for a while, and then he went back to his, you know, to his work. As such, and then when I, the next opportunity I got, I talked to Jose, and he came over and picked up the piece.
Why would these two boys keep this a secret all these years? Remy and Jose have a reason, and it dates back to Roswell.
We were there, you know, in 47 when Roswell happened, and we had, you know, we knew people that had ranches around, you know, around the area, okay? We knew people that knew a lot of stuff. They knew a lot of information that probably researchers would have loved to get a hold of. But that's, you know, that's way back in 45, 47. And when Roswell happened, it you know, I mean, there's a, you know, a credible story out there. But when Roswell happened, you know, it was like in about a couple of hours, 2-3 hours, and they shut that baby down. Okay, that thing was so tight, and we learned from them. You know, and I'm glad we did it, and I'm glad that Roswell happened, because we learned. There was people in San Antonio that knew a lot of things about Roswell. And there was people that came into San Antonio. You could tell that they were from the outside, because they either wore a tie and a white shirt, pants, or a black suit. They come into town and they talk to people. They go at the bar. The Yellow Bar and Cafe that we mentioned was very significant. That's the watering hole for Oppenheimer, and all those guys had lunch and maybe stayed overnight when they were traveling from Los Alamos to Trinity. Yeah, very significant. I mean, yeah. And so we saw people, you know, they come in and they'd ask questions. Do you know anything about Roswell? And somebody is, you know, being a good Samaritan, right? I say, oh yeah. I says, I know this and I know this. And then next thing you know, they're not no longer home. You don't see them. So, you know, we would ask, you know, we say, hey, what happened to such and such? Oh, says, you know, he's over at the sand. You know, and we didn't know what the heck the sand was, you know. But the sand was the sanatorium, the state mental hospital, Las Vegas, New Mexico. Lots of people went there for Roswell. You know, that's how they kept it down. And so once we knew that, guess what?
Jose Padilla and Remy Baca. And what they saw when they were young boys back in 1945. A UFO crash near the White Sands Missile Range. where they had just exploded a nuclear weapon for the first time. You have been listening to the story of the UFO crash before Roswell. We'd like to thank Paula Harris for her fine work. Jane Swartley has been our producer. I'm Jerry Pippin.
Go beyond the obvious and make Roswell, New Mexico, your brave new destination for fun and intrigue. Learn the truth about Roswell's history and see why Roswell's the mother of extraterrestrial connections. Whether you're looking for UFOs and aliens, cultural attractions, outdoor recreation, or even chewy mozzarella, there's plenty to uncover about this uncommon Roswell, New Mexico place. To find out more information on the mysteries of Roswell, visit www.roswellmysteries.com. Roswell, New Mexico. Visitors welcome.
As far as the Jerry Pippin Show is concerned, New Mexico was the home of all the big stories that we covered for 2010. And the second story, which was a close tie to the Paula Harris exclusive about the UFO crash of 1945, a year and 11 months before Roswell, is the story of Dulce. This is the Enchilada Mesa, where supposedly aliens reside. Phil Snyder made a lot of news about it at one time. Anthony Sanchez came forward and joined us in a show, along with a couple of other respected ufologists who specialize in Dulce, and that would be Dennis Malthaser from Roswell, who's done a lot of work on Dulce. And Norio Hayakawa, who now lives in Albuquerque and also specializes. In fact, he had a conference on Dulce a couple of years ago in which a lot of things happened that were pretty interesting. So let's go ahead and present portions of this interview that we did earlier in the year at Angel Fire, New Mexico, just a short distance away from Dulce. We did it at the lodge there before a live audience. And if you'd like to hear the entire show, just go simply over to probably the best place to find it would be iPodShows.net. It'll be there on the homepage on the panels, I think on the second or third row over to the right. Anyway, let's go ahead and present the show. And you'll see why I think it's a pretty close race on what was the top UFO story of 2010. A Jerry Pippin special. Dulce, what's really going on? Hi, we're from Angel Fire in New Mexico. And near here, there's a very mysterious place. It's referred to in ufology as Dulce. We'll find out what's happening. We have joining us today Anthony Sanchez, who drove all the way in from California. And he has a new book out that we'll be talking about in a moment. And our good friend Norio Hayakawa, who drove up from a suburb of Albuquerque. And Norio, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
And Dennis Balthizer will be joining us later. And Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, the name of your book is intriguing. Tell everybody about that.
The name of the book is UFO Highway.
And why did you come up with that title?
Well, initially when I started writing the book, it had nothing to do with Dulce. The book was to be about two core areas that I've specialized in for years now, which are the HARP and Project Bluebeam conspiracy, and alien-human hybridization with respect to human origins. And I also conducted an interview with Jorg Arnu of Area 51, and I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road, and I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
So all highways lead to the UFO answer?
That's correct.
And so it's just not about the the only highway that's reserved for extraterrestrial highway in the world, and that's Nevada.
Rachel, Nevada.
It goes up to Area 51 to Rachel. And Norio Hayakawa, you're no stranger there.
That's right. I had lots of amazing experiences. And in 1991, a bunch of us, about a six-car caravan, were dangerously harassed by unmarked military helicopter while we were driving on a public dirt road. And this was it became a news item in a UFO magazine in 1991. So, yes, I'm familiar with that highway. It's a lot of things happened at Highway 375, and now the highway is officially named the Extraterrestrial Highway, the only highway.
You listened to Billy Goodman years ago on KVEG out of Las Vegas, same station I was on, and I got to tell you something, Norio. Last week, I got a call from Gloria Euphoria. Remember her, his assistant?
I see, yes, yes, I remember.
She went up to Area 51, I think, when you guys went up to that bus tour.
Yes, that's right. That's a long time ago.
A long time ago
when hardly Area 51 wasn't even a household.
Even
yeah, that's right.
No one knew about Groom Lake even.
That's right. That was 1989.
Yeah, and Billy, I guess they chartered a bus or something, and they went up there. And
that's right.
So, Gloria was talking to me a little bit about that trip, and she still has some videos about it.
Yes.
Now, Anthony Sanchez, speaking of videos, you seem to have a pretty good ability about getting videos and photographs and things like that. You have a background in computers.
I have a degree in computer information systems. I've been programming since I was 10 years old, but I started programming in a professional capacity at about 1994 when I was 24 years old. And I've worked for companies like Intel Corporation, NEC, Hewlett-Packard. I've worked for your top companies in mostly in a software engineering capacity. So, yeah, I have a real strong computer background.
I'm remiss if I didn't ask you, when is that book coming out? December?
In December. So it should be out in the middle to the end of December.
Just in time for everybody to order for Christmas.
I hope so.
Norio, you don't seem to sell things. You give away things, your CDs and everything else.
Well, actually, Jerry, my philosophy is to distribute information to the public where it's needed. And my philosophy is that I personally just don't, you know, have the resources to publish anything at this time. More than that, I'm a person who likes to give out information to the public. That's the main goal. And that's why I'm so excited about telling the people that there is a new, brand new information concerning the alleged Dulce facility, and this came just this year from Mr. Sanchez's amazing interview with an Air Force colonel that took place this year in January in California. And this is a dramatic revelation of the reality that there is a facility in Dulce, no question about it.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Anthony, is that what do you call this colonel? Colonel X?
I give him the name
Colonel
X.
Z or what? I mean, yeah. We're not using his name, right?
We're not using his name. In fact,
and there's a reason for that.
There's a definite reason for it. The name he goes by today is not even his original name. When he retired from the military in 1983, starting his family, he actually changed his appearance, changed his name. And he's living a very, very anonymous lifestyle now, so under a new identity. But I am probably one of the few people that know his real name, his Social Security number, from his previous identity when he was employed by the United States military.
And so, in other words, you verified that he...
I have verified it. I have with me the DD-214. That with the colonel's permission, we got from the custodian of military records, and by filing the standard Form 180, we were able to get his military discharge papers. And the reason why we did that was because I am aware of a lot of incidents whereas people will approach UFO researchers give them false information and have them perpetuate a hoax for a long period of time. My good friend Dennis Balthaser was subject to one such event, and I'm trying to avoid that. This is the reason why I called Norio Hayakawa in on this project back in, I believe it was March, because I received the information in January, and I wasn't convinced because I never believed in the Phil Schneider story. I never believed in the Jason Bishop Tal story that's available online, the Bruce Allen Walton, the Branton stories. They just didn't. There was something about those stories that was unbelievable for me. So when this person approached me through another one of my insider sources who had previously done work as part of the military-industrial complex, I was very skeptical. So I contacted Norio Hayakawa because of his expertise in Dulce and his skeptical nature of the subject, and I took various steps. First thing I did was I had the colonel submit to two polygraph examinations. I hired a private investigator who was a retired law enforcement officer. He's now a private investigator in Northern California. And he conducted two polygraph examinations for me, and the colonel passed both of them. And then we submitted a standard Form 180, received his discharge papers, his DD-214, and he told me, when you get my discharge papers, there is a clue on there that you need to look for, and when you find it, you need to research it, and that will give you your validation. So when we received the DD-214 under section 18, which is the remarks area, which is a very important part of the DD-214, I found the clue. I found the clue that he was referencing to. There was a military personnel designation of 14N4, which I looked up, and it had something to do with an intelligence specification. After that, it said staff, Rio Arriba CO, comma DSD hyphen 3. So Rio Arriba CO stood for Rio Arriba County. And so I contacted two independent custodians of military records, one in Maryland and one in Louisiana. When I asked the custodian in Maryland what Rio Arriba CO stood for in DSD-3, they said they'd never heard of it. When I asked the custodian in Louisiana, they said that's classified and that they don't even have a definition for it, but that it's classified. So I called up the Dulce Township and spoke to several people throughout Dulce trying to find out if there was any type of military establishment there within Rio Arriba County where Dulce is. And they said there's nothing there. So I said, well, is there a recruiting office? Because maybe he was a recruiter and he's making up the story. They said there is no recruiting office there. There hasn't been a military presence in Rio Arriba County since the Calvary was last there. So this is what I had been able to ascertain from these discharge papers. It's very important.
This is just amazing, and this is a definitive proof that this person, the colonel, was a staff of Rio Arriba County DSD-3, and he received a full retirement merited under special order for DSD-3 service. And there's no question in my mind that this is an authentic document, and he verified everything. By the way, Jerry, when I held the first underground base conference last year in 2009 in March in Dulce, apparently this gentleman, the Air Force colonel, was in attendance. He testified in the interview with Anthony Sanchez.
I remember when you were having that, I had you on the phone direct from there, and I asked you if anybody of importance is there, and you said, I think there are many people here that are...
Yes, in fact, he confirmed that there was there were two AFOSI personnel there in the audience. Yeah, and then he also confirmed the presence of a strange military helicopter.
Yeah, that thing was early in the morning.
Yeah, early at 6 a.m. He confirmed his interview.
Yeah, at 5:55 a.m., the colonel says that he was in his car with his wife and they were having coffee, and above the Best Western Jicarilla, the inn, there were two helicopters that had arrived simultaneously. One hovered over the inn while the other circled the area scanning various vehicles, including the vehicle that they were sitting in. And the other one, so the one circling the area scanning departed, the one hovering remained for a couple more minutes, and then they both disappeared. And when I asked him if it was possible that these helicopters were a part of the intelligence division that he had been a part of, DSD-3, he said yes. Those were most likely helicopters, not from the Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI. They were more likely from the DLSI.
In other words, DSD-3.
Now, Norio and Anthony, there's no doubt in either of your minds that there's something going on at DLSI. I mean, something top secret.
No question about it. I was just in DLSI about 10 days ago, and a good friend of mine now, former Highway Patrol officer Gabe Valdez, he even goes to the DLSI area to, you know, conduct his ongoing investigations into DLSI. He definitely says that there is something there. There's no question in my mind that some kind of a military presence and some kind of a cover-up is being conducted in this mysterious location called DLSI.
Now, Anthony's going to get into what he found out about what that cover-up might be. And I know, Norio, you and I've talked about it, and we all know the Phil Snyder story, and we kind of dismissed that, but Anthony seems to have some evidence. Has he convinced you? You're open-minded about it.
I'm very open-minded. In fact, my position is that we should weigh everything carefully and always leave the door open, halfway open, to accommodate any possible, situation.
So, Anthony, and as you reveal the story, I think people can make their own mind up here, but it appears to me it might be all of the above. It is a U.S. government deal. There might be some biological stuff going on, and there also is this extraterrestrial.
That's a very interesting point. I have to preface this by saying that this was amazing when I first heard it. I was not inclined to believe any of it until I had the chance to speak with an expert. That's why I chose Norio for this, because he knows a lot about the background. He was on UFO Hunters. He was profiled on UFO Hunters. And he has a whole bunch of experience in researching DLSI. So the testimony that I gathered from this colonel during our interview, he claims that in 1940, there was a group called the Muroc Expedition, which came out of Muroc Army Airfield, which is Edwards Air Force Base today. They were sent there as part of an expedition. They were a ground crew complementing a pilots who were surveying Nevada, New Mexico, for our future atomic development. And the book goes into detail about this. But they found a massive cavern there, in DLSI at the Archuleta Mesa. That cavern's not there anymore. The cavern was covered up at some point, and I'll get into that later. It's not unlike the caverns you see when you're driving in from northern Arizona into New Mexico. There's massive caverns. I saw plenty of them on the way in as I drove in. This is exactly what he described to me. And he says that these soldiers from the Muroc expedition had gone in, and they had found some very, very interesting artifacts. They found remains, and they found evidence of a fight that had occurred there. Interestingly enough, a fight that had occurred there a while back, quite a while back. And so it was a very interesting aspect of the story. And this is kind of what stood out to me that made me want to show some interest in this story, because it was nothing like I had ever heard about DLSI that is widely available on the internet right now, which talks about reptilians and things of that net nature. This has nothing to do with that. This is more grounded, with a more earthly type explanation as to why we're there, why we're performing work there, and why we work with people, the inhabitants that they found there. So what they found inside this cavern were remains of Apache warriors. They found remains. They were able to determine that The remains were from between the years 1840 and 1870. They were able to corroborate that by the fact that they found Colt revolvers, Winchester repeater rifles, and spent and unspent ammunition strewn about. They also found blades, Apache-style blades. They could tell by the wrapping, the leather wrapping, and there was a whole bunch of different explanations as to why they were able to determine these were indeed Apache warriors that they found in there. Next to the Apache remains, but further in, he claims that they found, now these are the soldiers of the Muroc expedition who found this, small diminutive remains of these, they were human-like, they had larger heads, they had huge eye sockets, and they were everywhere. And there was obviously some type of a battle that had ensued some time ago. As they went deeper into the cavern, they began to find evidence of machines. You have to keep in mind that this is 1940. There were no laptops. There were no personal recording devices. So the soldiers were told to keep journals. Typically in those days, you would have a commanding officer or an officer with one or two soldiers assigned to handwriting in their journal of what they found. And this is exactly what they did. And Colonel X found all of this evidence in the briefing documents that were provided to him in 1979 when he was told to report to Edwards Air Force Base en route to a base he had never heard of, somewhere called Dulce, New Mexico. And actually, it wasn't referred to as a base. It was referred to as a scientific auxiliary. So there's a lot more detail that I could go into, but essentially, that's the crux of the story. He operated out of McClellan Air Force Base near Sacramento, California, part of a larger medical unit, but a small specialized detachment that responded to Type X events, as he called them. And these would involve incidents of a UFO nature, but only if there was an accident or if there was a death of military personnel. And he recalls a story that occurred near Fort Irwin to give me an example of exactly what he's referring to. His job was to conduct a real simple protocol, four-step protocol, conduct an initial, some type of a behavioral assessment, psychological assessment on the spot. If these people are not fit to return to duty, they receive an immediate medical discharge, no questions asked, answered, you know. It's a very strict group that he belonged to. So he says that in 79, he received this packet with the new set of orders, and what was different about these is that they were labeled Department of Energy, and he had never seen that before, and it also had this specialized compartmented information stamp on there, which is something he had not seen before. Now, he had always dealt with all of the events that he dealt with were classified, these Type X events, but this one in particular stood out to him because it had a orders to immediately report to Edwards Air Force Base en route to Dulce, where something had occurred 48 hours earlier, which triggered a set of protocols enacting a demilitarized zone.
Are you saying that it was 1979?
It's 1979. Now, what's interesting about that is this correlates to this Phil Schneider business, whereas Phil Schneider came about in the early to mid-90s talking about his involvement in a battle that occurred there. Now, according to the testimony provided by the colonel, about 90% of that information that was being espoused by Phil Schneider on the lecture circuit was false. But he confirms that Phil Schneider was indeed working at Dulce under a geological specification for a subcontractor, it's part of a federal contractor, to a prime called URS Corp. He was there under a geological specification doing geological work. So that is interesting to note. What is also interesting is the colonel said that there were 23 people that were unaccounted for after these hostilities had occurred there in 1979. Phil Schneider was one of those 23 people. He doesn't understand why, but when he resurfaced in 1995, he started making these claims about what had happened there in Dulce. But his supposition is this. He says he thinks that Phil Schneider latched on to the story that was being propagated by Bob Lazar about this event. Now, Bob Lazar never claimed where it occurred, but there was this event where there was hostilities between Greys, or extraterrestrials, as he put it, and Delta Force type of, special ops soldiers. Now, the colonel, when I interviewed him, said he believes that Phil Schneider was trying to associate himself to that event for purposes of sensationalism and to draw greater attention to what occurred with him in Dulce.
That's very important, Jerry, because everybody has heard about the so-called 1975 altercation between unknown entities and, U.S. Delta forces. But this idea or this claim was first brought out by none other than Bob Lazar in 1989. So by 1995, in my opinion, Phil Schneider probably has heard about Bob Lazar's claim that there was an altercation. But Bob Lazar, when he came out with this statement in 1989, never mentioned that this altercation took place whether at Groom Lake or at other facility. He never mentioned it. So my take is that, yes, Phil Schneider started talking about it in 1995. And, perhaps, there's some truth to that he may have been part of, that crew or geological crew.
Let's play a little bit of Phil Schneider, the late Phil Schneider, telling about this altercation.
The unbelievable part, I was involved in building another base inside of Dulce, New Mexico, which is Los Alamos Laboratory. It's a biological laboratory. On the southwest part of the Archuleta Mesa, we built an underground facility, a better part of 3 cubic miles hollowed out underground. Then to the southwest of that, we were in the process of the early stages of building. We drilled 4 large tunnel-like holes. Some of them ran 2.5 miles under the surface. Number of the original wells or drilling machines that were used were at the rate of 2 miles a day. It was fairly rapid. The equipment kept coming up broken. So we wanted to go down. We wanted to send somebody down there, a human observer, or human observers in this case, to find out what was going on. Well, to our total surprise, first of all, the government knew all about it. They didn't tell anybody. When I saw Green Beret and Black Beret people encamped inside of our geologist's camp, I knew something was up. The large alien grays had been encamped there for as best as believed possible about 400 or 500 years. It had been one of their internal bases. And we'd drilled holes right on top of it. All the stinking air, all the black sooty air came right out as soon as the first hole was sunk and all this soot came up. And well, that's when all the hell broke loose, really, all started. Anyway, after we drilled all 4 holes, it took about 2 days to drill all 4 of them. And when you build an underground base, you drill 4 basic holes, and then you build called stopes or cross-member holes across, and then you use blasting equipment, special blasting equipment by the analyzation of the rock formation, and you literally blast out or tunnel out or deflagrate or melt rock out to build the large rooms that are required for this underground base. Well, in this process, I was lowered down the basket of one of these holes, and about from me to this elderly woman here in the front was sitting a 7-foot-tall alien gray. The stench was worse than the worst garbage can you can imagine. The person the entity was absolutely horrible. I didn't waste any time or reach for my pistol. At that time, as an engineer, I didn't have time to carry all the folder, all of one of these big submachine guns that all the sea spray and the yellow fruit and all the outer perimeter and inner perimeter security people carried, I carried old Walther PPK pistol with a 9-shot clip. This was in late August of 1979. Now, you got a regular suit of clothes, you got a regular clothes on, plus you're in a almost like a spacesuit environment, and you're reaching for a gun, it's not the easiest thing to do, and then to pop a clip in it and start shooting. And I killed two of them. Yes, they're mortal, and they do die.
Right back at Angel Fire Resort with more about Dulce and what's going on. I'm Jerry Pippin. We'll return to our Dulce story in a moment. One of the great things about the Jerry Pippin Show is that everything is on demand. By that, we mean you listen when you want, not when we tell you. It's available always as a podcast MP3, available for your favorite sort of a device that you want to use to download, including, of course, the famous iPod. In addition to that, we also offer Windows Media files for people who listen on their PCs. Check us out often. We do all kinds of shows. And now back to part two of the Dulce story.
Jerry Pippin special, Dulce, real or not, we're at Angel Fire in New Mexico, and Anthony Sanchez is with us. Anthony, that's an incredible setup that you told us, and we'll get back to it in a little bit.
Thank you.
How did you meet the Colonel? Did you ever see him face to face? You must.
Yes,
have.
I did, actually. So I worked at a semiconductor company as a software engineer. I worked in a senior software engineering capacity. Now, I cannot say who the company is because I don't want to get in trouble with this company. However, I was doing something called computational metric analysis, whereas I was writing scripts for engineers who were testing brand-new integrated circuit designs. There was an engineering corps and there was a technician corps. The engineers, like myself, had been there for years. I'd been at this company for years. The technician corps, this was a high turnover group. They would come in, you'd see them, they'd be there for a few months, and then they were gone. Well, I had encountered this one individual, one technician, who had way more education than I did. But he and I struck up an acquaintanceship, and we became friends for the time that he was there. He was there for no more than 5 months. And then one day he just disappeared. And the last conversation I had with him, we had discussed my UFO blog. I had a blog. This is in 2007. And I never seen him after that. He just disappeared. A year later, this is about December 2008, I get a call from this person, and I immediately recognize his voice because he had an English accent. And then in the middle of our conversation, he dropped the English accent. And then he confirmed to me that I'm not English, I'm American, I'm AWOL from a specific project that I had been working on for a defense contractor near Moffett Field in the Bay Area. I was working on a low Earth orbit nanosatellite interceptor defense program, which I'm not at liberty to discuss because I don't want to get in trouble with the federal government. I have enough information on that alone to write a book, but I'm not going to touch it, because it's a very sensitive piece of information, and it's in the interest of our national defense, and it's protecting you and protecting me, so I don't want to go there. However, I stayed in touch with him during that time, and I guess it was about a year after that, he got me in contact with this colonel. He says, I have an individual who is interested in some of this genetics research that you've been writing about in your blog. And he wants to ask you some questions. So I met the colonel. He called me on my cell phone. Incidentally, I have his cell phone number. I have his email address. And I met with both him and his wife. And It's very interesting, but the colonel is now, after he retired from the military in 1983, he now has a new identity. He has a new face. His family, which had begun at that
time. What do you mean he has a new face?
He underwent complete transformation of identity.
Had you seen him before? Do you know what he looked like before?
I did not see what he looked like before.
Yeah, I was just curious.
But I do know what he looks like now. And anyhow, that's how I met the colonel. It's very interesting. He teaches at a university in Northern California. He has two postgraduate degrees in psychology. And he informed me that after the information is disclosed, he will be transferring somewhere else within the country.
And I believe you told me in a post-interview, or one of our producers, or maybe Norio, that you're not going to hear from him.
He told me once this book publishes and the information is disclosed about Dulcie, that I will have no further contact with him. And I was a little bit dismayed at first, but I can understand why after studying the information that was provided to me in this 92 pages of testimony. I have recorded audio 3 hours with the colonel. I plan to make that public, but I'll have to find someone who can take that into the studio and disguise his voice or something. I don't understand that technology, but that was part of the agreement.
We've done a little bit of that.
Yeah,
Norio Hayakawa, we've talked about this a lot, and you more or less kind of dismissed Phil Snyder at one time, I think.
Yes, I was very skeptical of the claims of Phil Snyder, but again, you know, we just don't have irrefutable documentary evidence for Phil Snyder's claim. So until such documentation surfaces, I will, you know, accept. But I keep an open mind. And from a research point of view, it's very important to have a healthy, skeptical attitude towards everything. And so I don't believe in debunking. I don't believe in believing right away. But I just keep open skeptical, healthy skeptical attitude, and that's the best way, in my opinion. But in comes this amazing information that just surfaced this year, which is the interview, a 3-hour interview with this colonel in California in January. And so I'm just so excited about the Anthony Sanchez upcoming book that's going to come out in December that will reveal everything from a realistic standpoint of view, backed by a documentation, which we just talked about. And I think there's no question in my mind that there is a facility in Dulce that is being covered up. And it may not be something that we imagine it to be. It could be it could be anything, but there is a definite military operation in Dulce. There's
if
no
I could
question
add
about
one point, Jerry. Ironically, while I was vetting the colonel to prove who he was, he says he was, it was the U.S. federal government that proved to me who he was. I filed a standard Form 180, received his discharge papers from his military service, where he told me that on this document I would find the clue as to his service. And there it is, and it's right here, and it will be in the book.
Dennis Balthaser, welcome. I know you were a little late because you're busy doing a little MC work.
I have been.
And you went to the conference that Norio had down in Dulce.
Yeah, Norio invited me up 2 years ago, I believe it was.
Last year.
Time flies. And we were expecting maybe 20 people if we were lucky, and I think we had 120 or 130 there. But I've been interested in Dulce for the last 10, 12 years. In fact, I worked with a researcher from Georgia for some time, and we had planned on taking either a hunting trip or a fishing trip up to the Dulce area as a cover to do some snooping around up there. And after some discussions about that over a period of a year or two, he called me one night. He said, "Dennis, I'm not talking about Dulce anymore." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "My wife has been run off the road twice." He said, "I've been run off the road once." He said, "We're getting threats on the telephone." He said, "I can't afford to continue to look into Dulce." I have forever thought that something is going on at Dulce. As most of you know, Area 51 up in Nevada went into existence in 1955. We didn't find out about it until we found a Russian satellite picture, and that was the first we knew about it. So what is going on at Dulce, I'm not quite sure about. But like Norio, I'm convinced that something is happening there, and I'm glad to see Anthony doing what he's doing, because to do this research, there are too many people out there we call debunkers and skeptics that are just waiting to jump on us. Unfortunately, they never come up with any new information, but they're willing to get on to the serious researcher about what we say. So I think Anthony's taking the right approach. He's getting documentation, and he's got validation for what he's saying. We don't know the answers yet, but we're definitely going to work on it.
Now, Phil Snyder, of course, committed suicide with a piano cord.
With one hand.
And others have died. You've had people following you.
Yes.
Norio, I think somebody was out taking a picture yesterday.
In fact, yesterday, when Anthony Hilden, Sanchez and I left Rio Rancho to come here, there was this gentleman that was taking a picture of us near his van.
Yeah, a black truck. He had a black unmarked truck.
Have you ever been threatened, Norio?
No, I haven't been threatened at all, except in 1991 when I thought I was going to die from this helicopter attack. But anyway, you know, one fascinating information I got, and I can verify, is that the story about Thomas E. Costello has no evidence. In fact, there's no such a person named Thomas E. Costello, and this colonel confirmed that the Thomas E. Costello story never is based on any fact. This was even confirmed by a friend of mine, former state patrol officer Gabe Valdez, who examined a lot of cases in Dulce, and he even told me that there's no Thomas E. Costello as described in the rumors. But that doesn't mean that the whole Dulce story is a fake. There's definitely something in Dulce.
Dennis Balthaser, you've had encounters with secret agents. We found out later they were fraudulent.
Yeah, it took me 12 years to find out I was hoaxed. I went over to Oklahoma to pick up a piece of metal from a guy who said he had been at Roswell. And it took me about 12 years to find out that I was set up. And you never know those things when it happens. I went to Oklahoma. I was supposed to meet a gentleman, never got to meet him. Two people met me that said they were Air Force OSI agents. Changed my life for a while. I lost 15 pounds in about 3 months, and it was pretty spooky.
I remember when we did that show back here, 2000 or so?
Yeah, I was wanting to prosecute if I could find out who they were, because they were imposing federal agents, and that's a federal offense. But it took 12 years and statute of limitations ran out, so I guess I'll chalk it up to experience.
And the reason I brought that up, all three of you can answer this. It seems, maybe it's the government's plan, but it seems there's a lot of would-be guys out there, a lot of people acting, I call them lone rangers, and then there's the real stories. And like as you said, Anthony, earlier, this colonel verified maybe 10% of Phil Snyder's story.
That's right. So that's the reason why I called in Norio Hayakawa. I had to have somebody with a skeptical viewpoint of the entire Dulce story. Like I said, I never believed in this reptilian-based storyline surrounding the whole Archuleta Mesa. And so for me, it was difficult to quantify the data that I was receiving from this colonel and try and extract elements of reality from it. So when I brought Norio into the picture, Norio was able to give me a historical perspective on possibly how this whole reptilian story came about. And what we were able to discover was that the real information revolved around Paul Benowitz and Myrna Hansen. Those are two real people with two series of events that were real. They really happened.
And Paul Benowitz committed suicide.
Yeah, so but not before he was committed to, I think it was a mental health institution. So it's a very, very tragic story with Paul Benowitz. But I needed somebody with a skeptical viewpoint about the whole Dulce story to help me, and that's why Norio was involved. And, we found out a lot of information. Essentially, what happened was the Benowitz story and the Myrna Hansen story were taken. They were stretched. They were fabricated. They were augmented with these reptilian lies. And they really just created this whole new storyline that's propagated around the world. It's a good story.
Like when you buy boxes of cornflakes or something, when they used to give the little prizes, The truth is in there somewhere. You've got to shake this box around.
If I may, I'd like to read this real short passage from the interview that I conducted with the Colonel. I asked him, I said, Colonel, what do you know about Thomas Edwin Costello? Did he really exist? I said, this is what people are going to want to know. And this is what he said to me. He said, the story is not real. If I cannot validate the existence of Thomas Costello, no one can. The name never appeared on any documentation in the DSD-3 personnel database. When that whole story emerged, I looked long and hard at the data, noting down the various names of the principals involved. And I'm telling you with all conviction that I had my sources within my own intelligence circles access the DS-3 personnel database to check. They double-checked and found nothing validating the name Thomas Edwin Costello or such a person ever having been to Dulce. He even hired a private investigator. He said, I hired a private investigator to attempt to locate Thomas Edwards Costello and his supposed family, Eric Costello, his son, and Kathy Costello, his wife. He found nothing. This man and his family simply do not exist.
Amazing.
One more thing. He said to me, I personally conducted an extensive independent search within the National Archives and Records Administration database, and nothing turned up. I also performed an exhaustive search in the Social Security Administration Death Index, and nothing turned up. Finally, a search in all the known U.S. military personnel locator databases for Costello, with him being a supposed United States Air Force sergeant or master sergeant. Nothing turned up.
And if you want to hear the entire show, you can go over to, as I say, probably the best place to find it would be iPodShows.net. It's also available at JerryPippin.com. Just put in the search mechanism Dulce Shows. It'll come up as well. Dulce's got some pretty interesting things cooking for 2011, by the way. Norio Hayakawa has done some good research on a ranch, a very mysterious ranch right outside of town in Dulce. And we will probably be doing a show with Norio about that pretty quickly. And Norio may even try to have another Dulce conference. As far as the Angel Fire conference, I think next year it might be in Taos. It's not officially been firmed up yet, I don't think, or at least they haven't told me. But we'll keep you informed on that. Janet Saylor always does a great job at aspie.org. I'm going to check her out and what she's up to. Good paranormal stuff there as well. Now, we got other news that we could talk about, but our time's almost up. We wanted to play the couple of the shows that we thought were highlights for 2010. We hope you enjoyed them. And I guess the other story that would be warranting some coverage would be the Roswell mess. There's been a big election in Roswell. New mayor comes in. He's backed up by some private people who want to move all of the festivities back to the UFO Museum. The city of Roswell's been doing a great job promoting it. I don't really care for what they've been doing, so I'm not coming this coming year, I don't think. But they will have some interesting things there at Roswell, and we'll have some great Roswell shows. Might stay tuned for that in 2011 as we continue. But I don't know that we'll show up there in person this year. I don't think so. I don't care for what the UFO Museum's been doing. They started out to be really a great place, but they've been, captivated by money or whatever. I just don't know. Anyway, our time is up. We'll see you next week when, once again, we do more of Jerry Pippin's UFO Files. James Whitley has been our producer. I'm Jerry Pippin. Thank you for listening. Cheers.
Tales of High Strangeness, Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com.